Tes Vov Sivan, Friday the 13th of June, Rabbi Rashi Simon. Lessons from the Meraglim, self-respect and the Jewish problem.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here as always. This is my first time in this context of this greatly enhanced Aron Kodesh. I feel actually inadequate standing here, but I've always felt inadequate standing here, but now even more so. Our subject, as we just heard, is self-respect and the Jewish problem. And what I want to share with you derives essentially from a short passage in Michtam Eliyahu. You may have come across it, you may have learned it already, but in case you haven't, or even if you have, I think it's a very keen insight into human nature and into, as I say, the Jewish problem, certainly in modern times. The Parsha, of course, is dominated by the Meraglim, and I suppose the overarching problem is, why did the Meraglim apparently intend to sabotage the Ratzon Hashem? I'm not going to be able to answer that question today, maybe on another occasion. But I will explore with you one aspect of their report. The Meraglim seemed determined to undermine, determined to thwart the intent of enabling the Jewish people to claim their patrimony, to enter the land, Zavas Chalav Dvash, and they're casting around for ways to intimidate the Jewish people, ways to convince them either it's not worthwhile to enter the land or it will never succeed to conquer the land. And it says, V'yotziyu divas ha'aretz. Now, the truth is that the first part of their report was accurate. This, many Meforshim point out. It's only when they began to editorialize, Ramban says, that the beginning of the shift, which initially was subtle and then became much more explicit, was when they said, Efes ki asa'am. The land is a good land, it's very productive, and this is its fruit, and the yield is very impressive. Efes ki asa'am. However, the people there are too powerful. And then they warm to their theme, and it says, V'yotziyu, subsequently, V'yotziyu divas ha'aretz asher Tara osah el b'nei Yisrael, that they sought to malign, divas ha'aretz, they sought to malign the land. Ha'aretz asher avanu ba lasur osah eretz, lasur osah eretz ocheles yoshvei, it is a land which devours its inhabitants. The most evocative imagery. Eretz ocheles yoshveha. It's a great land, but there's a toxicity to it. Apparently, maybe the air and maybe the water. Great and powerful people are brought to their knees and they're dying. When we were there, we saw a spate of funerals, as Rashi famously explains. The people we saw there were anshei midos. It doesn't mean they had good midos. It means they were people of measure, of stature. Like if you meet someone, you see someone who's 6'6", or 6'8", or 6'10", you say, wow, how tall are you? It's like they're all members of the Canaan basketball team. Anshei midos, and then they mention the Nephilim, you know, Bnei Anak mean a Nephilim. And then they conclude with the following enigmatic turn of phrase, and that's what I'd like to explore with you this morning. Vanehi be'einenu kechagavim, v'chein hayinu be'einehem. We were in our eyes as grasshoppers, as insects creeping around the place. Now, if you think about it, although their intent is clear, the turn of phrase is actually very surprising. What they really meant to say from the context is that they were so powerful, these people, so substantial, so fierce, and so awe-inspiring. They were Bnei HaAnak, they're giants, or descended from the giants. That hayinu be'einehem kechagavim, that in their eyes we were, or they're imagining that they must have thought of us as chagavim, you know, creeping around the place, because they're so powerful. Why did they say vanehi be'einenu kechagavim, that we were in our eyes kechagavim? What's the point how you were in your eyes? The point is that you're saying that compared to them, they regarded us as chagavim. This, I would suggest, is a kind of Freudian slip, where they revealed what they were really thinking without intending to do so. And I'd like to share with you, as I said at the beginning, a short essay or part of an essay in Michtam Eliyahu. It's in the third chelek, and I'm sure you are aware that most of the contents of the book, Michtam Eliyahu, is about 4 or 5 volumes now, were not written actually by Rav Dester's hand. They were mostly written by the notes of the Talmidim. Some of them were recorded, most of them probably just with the notes, and subsequently they wrote them up. Most of the books of the volumes were published after his passing even, so whether he reviewed them, I don't know. But what is interesting to me, I'm sure many of those who've heard me speak here in the past or elsewhere probably as well, are conscious of the fact that I have a great fondness for history, for Jewish history, and one of the, for me, added value to the Michtam Eliyahu is that frequently the editors have told the reader when this drasha was given, when and where. And this particular drasha was probably given, I would imagine, in Parshas Vayishlach, as we'll see why in a moment. And the year is Tafshin. The year is 1939. We're talking about autumn 1939, which would have been probably within weeks. Tafshin is 1940, but it was in, I said, it was Parshas Vayishlach. Parshas Vayishlach is 1939. The reason I'm belaboring the point is that this drasha was given within weeks after the beginning of World War II, after Hitler invaded Poland on September 1st, and therefore, to me, this casts this drasha in a particularly poignant light. It is two perspectives on exile. He calls it Shtei Hashkafos al Hishtadlus v'Parnasa, and then Shtei Hashkafos al Hagalus. He speaks about Yaakov Avinu, and he speaks about the encounter between Yaakov and Esav after Yaakov returns from Padan Aram. After he has a large family, he's married Leah, he's married Rachel, he's got 2 other wives, he's got a large family with children, and he's finally coming back to Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Canaan, and he is mortified at the prospect of encountering his old nemesis, Esav. And again, as you know, he sends Malachim, and they come back, and they say 400 people, Esav is approaching, and Yaakov feels certain that Esav has malicious intent, malevolent intent. Now, whether Esav really had, it's a bit of an open question. But certainly that's what Yaakov thinks, or that's what he fears. And he initiates a charm offensive, tribute, and all of that. And finally, when the encounter happens, so the Torah describes how Yaakov prostrates himself before Esav 7 times. And Chazal are rather troubled by that. They're troubled by the spectacle of Yaakov humbling himself before Esav. Does he really regard Esav as so worthy, as so superior? He addresses him in such decorous, deferential language, and then he bows towards him. So Chazal are troubled by it. Chazal criticized Yaakov for it as well. Rav Dester quotes the Zohar, and the Zohar says, well, it appeared as if Yaakov was bowing to Esav 7 times. Esav probably thought of it that way. Probably the other people around there saw it in those terms as well. But that's not what really happened. Says the Zohar, V'hu avar lifnehem yishtachu arza 7 pamim ad gishto ad echav. V'chi Yaakov yihu shleime de'avhan. Could it be that Yaakov, who is the greatest, the most complete of the avos, Ishtam, Haich Sagi Leilahu Rasha de Esav Yehu Besitra de Elacher? How can it be that he prostrates himself before Esav, who is associated with foreign gods? V'Yaakov Lo Yisko Lahu Besitra Lahichu Kol Kla. How could Yaakov prostrate himself to the person who is the personification of a foreign god? Elamai, v'hu avar lifnehem, v'hu is a remez to the Shechina. V'hu avar lifnehem, the Shechina was present there. Yaakov was bowing to the Shechina, says the Zohar. It appeared as if he was bowing to Esav, but really Yaakov was bowing to the Shechina. I want to tell you what I think it means. Of course, superficially, it sounds as if it's a very facile way to obscure what has actually happened. See, he bowed to Esav? No, he saw the Shekhinah, so he bowed to the Shekhinah. Yeah, but nobody could tell. As far as everybody could see, he was bowing to Esav. What it means is that as far as Yaakov was concerned, in his own heart, he did not regard himself as inferior to Esav. He did not regard Esav as worthy of his homage. He was bowing to the Shekhinah. He realized that in accordance with his circumstances, as they are right now, what he has to do is to show great deference to Esav. As I said before, a charm offensive. He is desperate to do whatever he can to avoid an open conflict and to try to paper over the differences and to try to win the favor of Esav on this occasion. And it wasn't that he considered himself inferior to Esav, but it was just the exigencies of the hour, what he had to do at that time. And from this, Rav Dester takes us to what he calls Shte Hashkafos al Hagalos, two perspectives on exile. And he says, Bezeh Tamun Hasod Shagalos Me'olam Lo Pagma Benefesh Klal Yisrael. Says, in this is latent the secret of how it is that hundreds of years of galus, of persecution, of marginalization, of victimization, of being told by the nations of the world that we are inferior, that we are wayward, being reviled and execrated by our enemies for hundreds of years, how is it that that experience did not erode our self-respect? So he says, the answer is, Ki af shechnifu l'shoveihem, lo pa'al hazos aleihem klal. Yes, the Jewish people had to show, as it were, deference to our captors, the shoveihem, it means the captors. You know that during the whole Middle Ages, for the most part, the Jews in Europe never had any right to live anywhere. It's not that they had a natural position of security or citizens of any country. They had to plead generation by generation, sometimes year by year, for a charter to allow them to remain where they were. They may have been there for 50 years or maybe 150 years, but the next duke or the next poretz could decide, you know what, I don't want them anymore, off you go. This was the state of insecurity that the Jewish people lived in. They had to buy the favor, they had to win the favor, they had to bribe their way generation by generation. But they never regarded themselves as inferior to their captors, just the opposite. He says that betoch libam ra'u b'matzavam rav gezeres ha'makom v'lo yoser. They saw it as the Ratzon Hashem, for reasons which perhaps we cannot understand. But it doesn't mean that the people who are lording their authority over us are greater than us, are wiser than us, are superior to us, are more worthy than us, that their approach to matters of religion is better than ours, just the contrary. He says, and this is why, V'asonim lo itzlichu af pam lahachit etzel ha-yehudim es ha-karas ha-erech ha-atzmi ha-pnimi shalehem. You know, Rav Dessler was born in Lithuania. He came here to England, to London, as a young man, as a teenager, actually. He came with his parents. His father was a successful businessman. And he came from a distinguished family, but his father was not a rabbi. His father was a businessman. And he came to London because his mother was not well. And the doctor said, you know, the medical opportunities here in Lita are not as sophisticated. Maybe it's something to do with the weather as well. How they would come to London for the weather, I don't know. But anyway, they moved to London, and he had a difficult time here. You probably know that he was a rav in London for a number of years, very unappreciated, very frustrated. He taught a small circle of Talmidim, and that's where he had his real sibuk. And of course, from there, he went to Gateshead. That's why he went to Gateshead, to found Gateshead Kollel. I'm sure you know the story. They sent out, I think, 50 or 100 letters to all Rabbanim, and only one person wrote him back to say, I'm interested. Dessa was so desperate to get out of London. He figured even Gateshead has got to be better than London. And, of course, in Gateshead, he achieved great renown. And then the last part of his life, he was in Bnei Brak, in Ponovich. The point is, though, that Rav Dessler, the reason I tell you, to remind you of this, is that Rav Dessler was aware, he was alert to social and political and cultural trends in England of his day. He was not university educated, and I don't think he necessarily favored that, but he was alert to it. And that's why his writings, that's why he had such a profound impact on so many of his Talmidim, And that is why his writings have had such an impact on the Torah world, seminaries as well, because, as you probably know, many of the seminaries, not only Gateshead, but elsewhere as well, were founded by his Talmidim. And therefore, Rav Dessler's writings have exercised a great influence on the Jewish world, profound influence. But that is partly because he was alert to the trends of his time. And London at that time, as today, was a great cosmopolitan world capital. And no doubt, he became aware of things in England that gave him a perspective. And he brought the profundity and the creativity of Torah knowledge and insight into the modern world. So 1940-39 may not seem modern to us, but at that time, it was a time of great upheaval and great advances and great turmoil in the Jewish world and in the world at large. So he said what he's described in this short paragraph was in the good old days. There may have been bad old days in terms of persecution, but in terms of the Jewish self-concept, he says our sense of pride and, dare I say, superiority was never eroded, was never damaged by our circumstances. He says that was then. He says, Ke'ekachaya bedoros harishonim. So what happened was, with the Enlightenment, and with the advances in European society, and with the concomitant decline of the Jewish sense of pride, and sense of understanding, and sense of self, so what happened was an insidious and profound change. He said, what happened was, we began to, we began to accept the anti-Semitic caricature of the Jew. We began to internalize what they were saying about us. We began to think, you know what, maybe it's true, maybe we are corrupt, and we are primitive, and we are debased. Maybe it's really true. And he says, this was a profound change. He says, we began to think, you know what, let's see if we can follow their ways. We began to admire their ways. We began to seek to emulate their ways. It became very onerous, exceedingly onerous for us to be in exile, because we thought, we're missing out. We have really been deprived from all the great things about European culture, about the advances in politics and religion, and all of this is such a great improvement over what we've had. And we began to think of ourselves as taka inferior. He says, this is the great tragedy. He says, we became ashamed of our fathers, Rokde Mayafis. Mayafis is one of the Zmiros, and according to Jewish folklore, the Mayafis Yid is the Jew who's summoned by the Poretz to sing the Shabbos Zmiros and to dance, and the Poretz would, it was sport, it would be a way of mocking the Yidden. So he says that this is how the Jews began to think of themselves. They began to think of themselves as this sort of fawning, obsequious attitude towards our captors. And this had a tremendously deleterious effect on our own awareness and our own attitude towards ourselves. And he says, Rak acharei she'shafalnu anu, he says, because we become low, nisgadlu oyveinu be'einenu. We began to think as if, you know what? There is no redemption from this Golos. And he's referring here to the phenomenon of many Jews, many educated Jews, many wealthy and intelligent and sophisticated Jews in the West, especially in Germany particularly, who actually sought to convert to Christianity, to buy into the wonders of the modern world. And many men who did not convert outright sought, as I'm sure you know, to reform Judaism, to bring Judaism up to date. And he identifies as the failure of Jewish self-esteem as the cause of this, or a cause certainly. And then he says, Vezebid yuk, and this is what's the relevance to our parsha, Vezebid yuk kemamar hakasuv, this is what the pasuk says, Vanehi be'einenu kechagavim. It's a Freudian slip. They say that we were in our own eyes as chagavim. The point is, he says, that it's the loss of self-respect. It's because the Meraglim thought of themselves as inferior. So they imagined that probably the Canaanim thought of us as inferior as well. Rav Desta, I think, has captured the transformation and the tragedy of the Jewish encounter with modernity. Now, I have a passage here which I didn't come across in yeshiva. I came across it, in graduate school when I studied a bit of Jewish history. It's an article. It's a book by a certain scholar called Michael Meyer called The Origins of the Modern Jew. And he writes at length, in fact, the star of this book is Moses Mendelssohn. And it's a fascinating book for those who are interested, which probably doesn't include anybody in this room. But if you were, then this would be a useful book. I want to read you, though, a short excerpt from it. He said, excuse me? Yeah, okay. The truest expression of Mendelssohn's motivation, he's talking here about Mendelssohn's Be'ur. The Be'ur was Mendelssohn's translation of the Chumash into German. Now, this translation is a highly traditional translation, and the commentary is a highly traditional commentary. There is very little in Mendelssohn's commentary on the Torah, which is objectionable in objective terms, pointing to something which is picorsus or something like that. We can speak about it further another time, but that's not our subject right now. But he always said, why are you persecuting me? What's wrong? Many Jews, children and adults, don't understand Hebrew, which was true, so I'm rendering it into German so that they can understand the Chumash. What's wrong with that? Art school does it too. So what's wrong? Okay, a bit anachronistic. But this was his public response. But Michael Meyer writes as follows. The truest expression of Mendelssohn's motivation is unquestionably his letter of 1779 to his Christian friend, the Danish state councillor August von Hennings. Here he writes that his illness had largely incapacitated him from philosophy, but this is a quote from his letter. After some examination, I found the remainder of my powers could still suffice to render a good service to my children and perhaps to a considerable part of my nation if I were to put in their books a better translation and explanation of the holy books than they had heretofore. This is the first step to culture, something from which my nation sadly is kept at such remove that one might almost despair of the possibility of an improvement. In other words, Mendelssohn's intention in translating the Chumash into a high German was not so much to teach Chumash to those who don't understand Hebrew, but to teach German to those who don't understand German. It was a means of introducing into the Jewish curriculum the study or the familiarity with the learned, eloquent, literary German of his day. I want to read you another short paragraph. The Judeo-German jargon, of course that's Yiddish, symbolized for Mendelssohn, as for the generation of Maskilim who followed him, that foreignness and illegitimacy which is the sad mark of the pariah. The usually logical Mendelssohn was so set against the jargon, Yiddish, that he saw it as part of a cause and effect relationship which could hardly be proven. Here's another quote. I fear that this jargon, he wrote in 1782, has contributed not a little to the immorality of the common man, and I expect a very good effect from the increasing use of pure German idiom. Psychologically, there seems to be a trace of self-hate or simple shame in Mendelssohn's strange reasonings. Ideologically, the old speech represented for him the past which must be overcome and the very counterpole of the culture which must be achieved. So it was this acceptance of the anti-Semitic caricature of the Jew which was accepted, which was bought by Mendelssohn, by Naftali Herzl-Wiesel, Wesley, by Solomon Maimon, and many other names that you may or may not be familiar with. And by internalizing that anti-Semitic image, of course, they were desperate for a solution. They were desperate to somehow bring about an improvement in the state of the Jewish people, and it was this profound loss of self-esteem which tragically has set the stage for so much of so many of the changes in Jewish life. I just want to elaborate a little bit more, and we'll end with that. Previously, the relationship of the Yidden to their captors, as he says, can be summarize in a parable, which I don't know if it ever happened, but it's just a mushel. Imagine there's a Jewish fellow, maybe a balagola, simple Jew, sitting with his son, and he's driving his carriage, his wagon, and they get to a crossroads, and they have to wait because there's a long procession of stallions and horses going, and there's a big procession of the local porets, or maybe even the Duke. And he's going through with his long entourage, great entourage, and the Yid is saying to his son, you've got to learn Torah, you've got to be a Talmud Chacham, you've got to keep mitzvahs, you've got to be an Erech Yid. And he's going on and on, and then he sees the Duke passing with his all regalit, you know, the finery and all that. And he says, and if not, if you don't chas v'sholem, you could end up like that, Poretz. This was the attitude that had, but it all changed. Now, in 1920, I once did some research on the subject about self-esteem, and in 1925, a man in America published an article in the B'nai B'rith Monthly. He was a Jewish writer, a Jewish researcher, and he was writing about Jewish people, and he was writing for Jewish people. And the title of this article sums up its essence, and it's our subject for this morning. At least for another 2 minutes. He said, the title is, Have the Jews an Inferiority Complex? And he answers that, yes, they do. And he was writing in 1925, when these upheavals, and as we've said, the fawning sort of admiring position that the Jews had towards European culture and German culture especially was nearing its peak. And he said, yes, you know, we do have an inferiority complex. He said that Zionism has somewhat ameliorated this problem, somewhat, in a limited way. But he said, on the whole, we do have an inferiority complex, and we can understand why. Because when you give up what you are, when you deny what you are, when you lose your self-respect, then of course you do have an inferiority complex. I'd like to end with two short anecdotes. There was a play that was here in London about 20-25 years. I didn't see it, but it was called, I think, Ashena Madel. And it was suddenly made into a film called Miss Rose White. And the film describes, it's all fictional, describes two, maybe sisters or cousins, I can't remember, from Poland. And one of them comes to America before the war, maybe in the 1920s or 30s, and she becomes an ingenue, becomes Americanized, and her father makes a bit of money, and, you know, she's going for American fashion and American style and all of that. Her sister or her cousin doesn't get out in time, and she endures the horrors of the Holocaust, and she survives and comes to America as a penniless refugee. And her cousin takes her in, and initially the cousin, the Americanized cousin, is kind of uncomfortable with her because, you know, she's so European and so Polish and so Yiddish. And but after a while she begins to warm to her, and she says, you know what, you know, here in America you can leave behind the old world, there's such wonderful opportunities. She takes her to a clothing store, and she tries on a hat and a dress and a skirt, and she says to her that her name, the girl's name, is Reise Weiss. But she said, no, you can't call yourself that. You're going to be Miss Rose White. And that is the name of the film, Miss Rose White. So you've got a new name. So she says, you know, try on this hat and this dress. She says, try it, you'll be a different person. So the girl, the Polish girl, says to her Americanized cousin, she says, why do you always want to be a different person? And to me, that line just encapsulates this. It's a person who's trying to not to be himself, who's trying to deny who he really is and craving the acceptance of being something else. I'd like to just end with an anecdote, which is true. I'm sure that you know, or you've certainly heard of Dr. Tversky, Abraham Tversky, Shia Tversky. He's the scion of a very distinguished Hasidic dynasty. He grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and he lived much of his professional life in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he founded the Great Gateway Rehabilitation Center, and he's a very respected psychiatrist. Zion Gesundt, he's already in his 80s, still, Baruch Hashem, very productive. He turns out at one or two books a year, maybe more than that. In one of his books, he relates the following incident. Probably happened in the 60s or 70s. He said, I was on a coach in Pittsburgh. I was taking it maybe to the Catskills or wherever he was going. Now, you may know that in Pennsylvania, they have a group called the Pennsylvania Dutch. And these are a group of people who came from Europe, probably from German. Dutch is really Deutsch. The Americans call it Dutch, but probably it's the Deutsch initially. And
Amish,
yeah. They're the Amish and the Quakers and others like that. So they dress in a way which is, not that much different than some Yidden dress. And he tells the following story. Shia Twersky, all of his life, he's dressed ad hayom in Hasidic garb, and he with the hat and the langa rekel and everything. There's no compromise there. And I can assure you, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, it was not a common sight. So a woman came up to him on this coach, and she says, starts to berate him, and she says, how do you dress this way? You're inviting anti-Semitism. Why can't you get with modern times? Why do you cling to the outmoded ways and attire of an earlier century? So he looked at her and he said, madam, I don't understand what you're saying. I'm Amish. So she said, you're Amish? Oh, I think it's so wonderful the way that you haven't sold out to the trends of America, and how you've upheld the ways of your forefathers, and how you're so faithful to the traditions of your faith. So he looked at her again, he smiled and said, madam, 1,000 apologies, but really I am Jewish. But why is it that when I'm Amish you praise me, and when I'm Jewish you berate me? And of course the answer is that it's because of her insecurity. Because we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. And this is why he be'einenu kechagavim, that we thought of ourselves as inferior. Therefore, probably they also thought of us as inferior as well. But the beginning is with the person's own self-concept. I'm sorry we've gone over a little bit. Thoughts about the...